I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The head of the Philadelphia Parking Authority sexually harassed a colleague for 2 years, but was allowed to keep his high-paying job after spending $30,000 of public money on an investigation into his own conduct. That's according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, which published the revelations last night. Vince Fenerty remains executive director of the PPA, though he's been stripped of much of his authority. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron reports that some are calling for him to step down.
After the $30,000 independent investigation, the Parking Authority Board told Fenerty he no longer had sole power to hire, fire, or transfer employees, according to the Inquirer. But the board let Fenerty keep his title and his $223,000 salary. Felicia Harris, head of the newly formed Philadelphia Commission for Women, says the Parking Authority should have cut Fenerty loose.
And when you let something like that go without the proper consequences, you send a message. And the message that you send is that it's okay.
Mayor Jim Kenney did not call for Fenerty's resignation, but did reprimand the Republican ward leader and longtime Parking Authority employee.
The behavior is unacceptable but repugnant and would not be accepted or acceptable in this administration for many employees.
Kenney doesn't have authority over the PPA, which is actually a state agency. Governor Tom Wolf echoed Kennedy's sentiments, but also stopped short of saying Fenerty should go.
I haven't studied exactly what to do about it, but I'm troubled whenever I see people in positions of public authority and public responsibility do the wrong thing.
The PPA is run by a 6-member board. All members are appointed by the governor, but none of the current members was chosen by Wolf. In fact, the next spot on the PPA board won't come free until 2020. Fenerty declined to comment through a spokesman. WHYY attempted to reach PPA board chair Joseph Ashgill at his office, but was told he was out of town on business. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
100,000 inmates are held in solitary confinement in the United States, but a federal lawsuit settled in Delaware will put a dent in that number. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Kyrie Greenberg reports that Delaware is the latest state to reform both solitary confinement and mental health care in prisons.
Dan Atkins, executive director of Delaware's Community Legal Aid Society, says the first state's use of isolation was cruel and unusual punishment, and ultimately caused more problems than it solved.
There were individuals in solitary confinement who had a mental illness, and reports that there were people that were put in solitary confinement without a mental illness, and then during the course of their time being left in solitary, they had become mentally ill.
As part of the settlement between his group and the Department of Corrections, Delaware now guarantees 17 and a half hours a week of unstructured recreation for inmates who were previously held in isolation for up to 3 days at a time. Delaware prison officials estimate that 1/4 of inmates deal with some kind of mental illness. The agreement includes mental health trainings for staff and better access to therapy and job training for inmates. Corrections Commissioner Robert Koop released a statement saying that the new supports will improve the chances of successful re-entry into society. Kathleen McRae, director of the ACLU in Delaware, sees the settlement as the latest in a wave of reform over the past 5 years.
There definitely is a national trend, not only Pennsylvania, but Massachusetts, New York, Colorado, Indiana, Arizona, and Wisconsin have all seen major reforms to the way that they hold prisoners in solitary. And we're really pleased that Delaware is the latest addition to that list.
The ACLU says these suits gain traction due to growing evidence of the negative effects of isolation and the high costs of incarceration compared to community-based care models. Yet, Delaware, like the rest of the country, experienced a prison building boom in the 1980s and 90s, and that infrastructure supported isolation. So, McRae at the ACLU says that even if the evidence is on their side, it takes new thinking to implement different protocols.
we built the James Vaughn Correctional Center with 300 solitary confinement cells. I think Commissioner Koop has been very forward-looking, and we really commend him because his participation in these settlement negotiations were a big reason we were able to achieve so much success.
For WHYY News, I'm Kyrie Greenberg.
The select class of 2016 MacArthur Fellows is newly announced. Among the 23 recipients, composer Julia Wolfe. Julia, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
What's your trophy shelf look like? Is this going to be parked next to the Pulitzer, or you know, where is this one going to go?
It's been a good couple of years. I've got a little shelf here with some things on it in my studio.
Very cool. How did you come to learn that you'd won this award?
Well, it's very funny because they had a little trouble reaching me. You know, I looked at my cell phone and I got 3 calls from a number that I didn't recognize, so I don't always pick up my phone. And eventually, they actually had to email me and ask me some fake question. Actually, it was about some other thing. I thought, oh, maybe I can be helpful. Someone will get the MacArthur. And it turned out to be me, so to my surprise.
Are your students at NYU now concerned that you're going to pull the plug?
Well, no one has asked, and I don't plan to. So I really love teaching. I mean, it's a tricky balance, everything that you do in life. And certainly teaching, I give a lot to it. But it's an important part of what I do. Definitely still, I will be looking at my balance of time and how I manage them. You know, writing and some of the exciting, composing projects I have with a considerable demand of teaching. But no, they're in my hearts, and I've been actually texting many of them today. So it's I feel very connected to them.
How wonderful. We had you on when Anthracite Fields came out. And of course, if you living in Montgomeryville, Pennsylvania, as a child went north, you'd soon come upon coal country, Wilkes-Barre and Scranton. I understand your forthcoming work goes even a little bit further north to New York City and its garment industry.
That's right. And, you know, with all these pieces, I always have some kind of personal connection. So certainly with Pennsylvania being my home state and the region close to where I grew up was very meaningful to me. And so with the garment industry, the building, for example, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire is literally a block from where I teach. So there's a small plaque there. Actually, a new memorial is going up there, which I think is going to be so beautiful. And I walk by that building every day. So there's a connection just, you know, in terms of proximity to that. And then also just the whole history of immigration. Certainly my grandparents were part of that wave of immigration at the turn of the century. Just being a part of that culture of coming from Eastern Europe, it was mostly Eastern European and Southern Italian young women who were working in the factories at that time period, so in the garment industry. So very fun and fascinating to dive into this subject. I've already started reading and researching.
Let's talk about that dive a little. Of course, the MacArthur Fellow Award is bestowed for those breaking new ground in areas of public concern, often in unexpected ways. How will you bring your creativity to this issue?
Well, it's been so interesting to tell a story, a real story, so, telling history through music. Certainly many composers address subjects in their pieces in so many different ways. But I think that partly because of my early interest in social sciences, for example, I went to college thinking, I'm going to study social science, and I'm taking courses where we were reading about labor history and worker issues and things like that. And so I began with this very strong interest and then got really fascinated by writing music, and that's my calling and my passion. So that took over. And so it's really just in recent times I've made this kind of full circle back into the two merged. And it's just a pleasure for me to go back and take a look at these issues that are still very pertinent today. I mean, I'm looking at historical moments, but so many of the issues resonate today as well. So, but it's a great process, and something crazy and magical happens when you bring music into the story for me. So it's been a really very enriching.
Anthracite Fields premiered and was commissioned by the Mendelsohn Club right here in Philadelphia. What do you know about, what can you impart about the Philadelphia region music scene?
Well, Philadelphia is exploding right now. I think, you know, New York as well. It's a very fertile time for making music and so exciting. The Mendelsohn Club is so adventurous. I was just one of many, you know, composers, living composers that they commissioned. The Crossing, also a wonderful group. You know, just a lot of energy infused into the city, I think. And a lot of people moving there, but some New Yorkers that have now made Philadelphia their home. I think you can get some more space. There's been an interesting migration to Philadelphia that I've been watching.
You've been so generous with your time. Congratulations, and thanks for being with us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Composer Julia Wolf, part of the 2016 MacArthur Fellow Class. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Today, President Barack Obama handed out national awards for arts and humanities at the White House. Among the recipients, musicians, writers, poets, scholars, a chef, and Terry Gross, host of WHYY's Fresh Air. We sent our arts and culture reporter, Peter Crimmins, to the ceremony.
Thank you. Everybody, please have a seat.
President Obama welcomed 22 honorees into the East Room of the White House, along with a couple hundred friends and admirers.
I can tell there's a rowdy crowd. Sit down. Welcome to the White House, everybody.
Obama said, historically, the annual awarding of the National Humanities Medal and the National Medal of the Arts is a staid affair. But this year, he blamed recipient Mel Brooks for riling up the crowd. When he came in, Brooks made a gesture pretending to pull down Obama's pants. The president laughed it off.
As Mel Brooks once said to his writers on Blazing Saddles, which is a great film, write anything you want because we'll never be heard from again. We will all be arrested for this movie.
The medal recipients are identified by the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities. Obama said the awards highlight people who have a gift for creative empathy, who embody a diverse range of stories and art that reflect the national soul.
Now, along with Mel, we have an impressive crew with us here today. We've got Terry Gross and a whole bunch of people who Terry Gross has interviewed.
Recipients include composer Philip Glass, historian Rob Chernow, and a very pregnant Broadway star, Audra McDonald. 12 of them had appeared on Fresh Air over the years, sometimes more than once, but Gross said she actually meets very few of her guests. Her interviews are normally recorded in two different cities, linked by telephone.
Because the interviews are long distance, they're usually in a remote studio. Like, I've interviewed Mel Brooks, I don't know, two or three times. I never met him before. Philip Glass, same thing, never met him in person before. Isabel Wilkerson. Ron Chernow.
These award winners are accustomed to accolades. They're at the top of their respective careers and often recognized as such. But to be officially acknowledged by the president, backed by the pomp of the White House, is truly rare.
What a great occasion to meet them. Like, we're all so excited by the occasion that we've all been having a great time talking to each other.
Gross admitted she had never before been inside the White House, neither as a guest nor tourist. She was joined by her longtime executive producer, Danny Miller, who grew up in Washington, D.C., but had also never been inside the White House.
I've been outside the White House as a protester many times in my high school days, but I've never been inside the White House, so this is really a thrill.
The gravitas of being formally honored by the president at the White House was not lost on Gross.
There was a photo op beforehand, and he said back when he could drive, before he was president, that he used to listen to Fresh Air in the car. So that was really thrilling.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Bill Graham and the Rock and Roll Revolution at the National Museum of American Jewish History immerses attendees in many of the signature sights and sounds of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s popular music. To get a sense of the singular promoter who helped to bring the plays and players into prominence, I spoke with Bill's son, Alex Graham, and National Museum of American Jewish History curator Josh Perlman. Alex recounted what he knew of his dad's childhood.
He was in an orphanage, I think at least from the age of 4 or 5 until about 8. When he was 8, 1939 roughly, it was really not a good time to be a young Jewish kid in Berlin. And he fled with the youngest of his 5 sisters named Tola. And then they basically spent the next 2 years literally walking on foot across Europe through France, over the Pyrenees, through Spain, wound up in Lisbon, and on a boat in 1941, and then wound up in New York in September, I believe, of 1941.
Four of the five sisters survived.
Yeah.
His mom and one of the sisters did not.
His mom was captured and taken to Auschwitz. She did not survive. And Tola, the youngest sister who actually was with Dad, she was left behind because she became ill and couldn't carry on, and it's presumed that she died there. That part of Dad's life, I grew up not knowing a whole lot about. In the course of this exhibition being developed over the last several years, I've come to learn a lot more.
What seems pretty clear is your dad was robbed of many, if not most, aspects of childhood.
Fair to say that, sure.
And so he comes to America and quickly is desperate to become American, first losing quite successfully any vestiges of a European accent.
Yeah, I mean, he grew up in the Bronx after he was adopted by family in the Bronx, went to high school there. And because he had this thick German accent, they'd call him a Nazi. Obviously ironic. So he was very desperate to assimilate. You know, he was born Volodya Grajonza, WG. He took the initials WG, went to a Bronx phone book, selected William Graham. That's how Bill Graham was born. In the course of creating this exhibition, I've come to understand a lot more of where a lot of the mania came from and why he was so adamant about making sure people were safe at his shows and why it was so important to him that whatever power and ability you have, you use it in a way to help other people instead of hoarding it.
In 1985, he wanted to use and leverage his power to prevail upon then, I believe, the Reagan administration to reconsider a trip to Germany.
To Bitburg Cemetery, yep.
And it resulted in his office being firebombed.
Yep, and they never found out who did it. It was presumed it was, you know, it was Nazi sympathizers, but a significant part of what's in the exhibition was salvaged from the ashes of the office on 11th Street.
Josh, discuss this rebel with a cause whereby he felt increasingly the need to make sure that Rock made a statement and Rock made a difference.
Whatever relationship someone had with Bill, you can see them come alive when they start to talk about their experiences with him.
And I remember as a kid a few times saying, like, you know, why are you yelling at Axl Rose or why are you yelling at Carlos or whoever? And I saw an interview once with one of the Allman Brothers, and he made this sort of quip about how he's like, Bill used to levitate things with his temper, but he said it with a laugh.
Did he have a favorite?
Well, he loved Latin music and Afro-Cuban music because he was a total Latin dance freak.
Back in the Catskills with Tito Puente?
In the Catskills with Tito Puente, and even before, when he was a high school kid in the Bronx, there was a dance club called the Palladium, and they had a Wednesday night Latin dance contest, and he won that contest eventually.
Well, then I'm going to speculate that perhaps Carlos Santana was among his favorites.
Absolutely. There was a paternal aspect to their relationship. Dad loved Carlos deeply. Carlos has remained close with my family. I just saw him a few months ago. He was very, very supportive when Dad died, and he's someone that we'll be close with forever. We love him a lot.
Do you ever speculate what Bill Graham of 2016 might be up to?
We talk about this all the time. He was focusing almost all of his energy on trying to keep arts and music and physical education programs from being cut out of public school budgets.
That issue is, if anything, even more with us
today,
even here in Philadelphia.
You know, Bill carried with him a real commitment to philanthropy in both the smallest ways for individuals and in the massive ways he did through concerts. And I think that he really carried that value with him for his life, not only because he had come out of such dire circumstances, but because he saw that he had the opportunity to actually affect people's lives.
And still reverberating to this day.
Certainly. I think those things that he helped initiate or inaugurate so many years ago are still so present in our lives today, which makes his story even more vivid and meaningful and important to tell.
Alex Graham, Josh Perlman, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.